I'm Celeste Headlee, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Michelle Martin is away. An estimated 11 million people live in the U.S. without documentation. During the 2012 election, voters urged both major political parties to do something about what's often called our broken immigration system. In a moment, we'll hear about African-born immigrants who often feel they're overlooked in the immigration debate. But first, we take a closer look at new plans to overhaul the national system. A bipartisan group of senators released immigration proposals this week, and President Obama spoke about the issue in Las Vegas yesterday.
So at this moment, it looks like there's a genuine desire to get this done soon, and that's very encouraging. But this time, action must follow. We can't allow immigration reform to get bogged down in an endless debate. We've been debating this a very long time. So it's not as if we don't know technically what needs to get done.
Joining us to talk about what needs to get done and what is likely to get done, Doris Meissner. She's director of U.S. immigration policy at the nonpartisan Migration Policy Institute. She also served as commissioner of the Immigration and Naturalization Service during the Clinton administration. Welcome.
Thank you.
So as the president just mentioned, immigration reform has been bandied around on Capitol Hill for a very long time. We now have this proposal from the Gang of Eight senators and from the president. How are these proposals different from the one that we saw in 2007 under President Bush's administration?
The new thing about the Gang of Eight is the Gang of Eight. The new thing is that, in fact, there are a group of senators, Democrats and Republicans, who are talking and who have come up with a set of ideas that they are willing to put their reputations and their efforts behind. And the significant thing about that set of ideas that they've now put on the table, they were calling it their bipartisan framework. The significant thing about the framework, in addition to the fact that they've come together around it, it is the fact, I think, that on the Republican side, Republican leaders are signing on to the idea of a legalization program that includes ultimately a path to citizenship. That is a break or a change from the past. Senator McCain is a leader in all of this, and he was part of those kinds of discussions that endorsed a comprehensive approach in 2006 and 2007. But for 6 years in the intervening period, we have not had any kind of real willingness on the Republican side to talk about a comprehensive approach that includes a robust legalization program.
Which implies that this perhaps could be a proposal that could get done. Is that what you're saying? I mean, is that what makes it most important, that this could actually pass?
That is absolutely what makes it most important. As is just been reported in the president's remarks, the issues themselves have been around for a long time, and the approaches to how you would solve the issues are not very new. They're not new at all. But the real difference here is the politics. The real problem and the stalemate has been a political stalemate. So this is breaking through that, and it is a very strong starting point because it is a comprehensive approach, and it is an approach that ultimately includes this legalization piece that the Republican Party has been so opposed to for so many years.
I hate to be cynical about it, but I have to imagine that this is at least mostly influenced, this change of attitude is influenced by the recent election and the shifting demographics in the country, that they're looking at a Latino population whose vote they did not earn in the past election.
Absolutely. And I wouldn't call that cynical. I would call that waking up and smelling the coffee. The fact of the matter is that this change in our demographics has been talked about and reported endlessly, but it took this election to seem to make that be real and have that breakthrough to a range of political leaders, but particularly when the Republican Party has seen how badly it lost based on that change. This is looking at reality.
Well, let's talk about the framework itself. The president said we know what needs to be done. Now we just need to get it done. Does this framework accomplish what he's talking about? Is it what needs to get done?
Well, of course, this is still very general.
It's right.
Still very much at the level of themes and core ideas. But that's where you have to start. And if you look at what the bipartisan framework puts on the table, and then you look at what the president put on the table after his speech, there's an enormous convergence or similarity. Now, there are going to be difficulties in the details, but they are starting with a comprehensive approach, and if they can work out the difficulties and the tensions among, you know, within those issues, we'd have something that could happen here.
I'm Celeste Headlee. We're talking about renewed federal efforts toward comprehensive immigration reform. My guest is Doris Meissner of the Migration Policy Institute and a former commissioner of the Immigration and Naturalization Service. Well, as you mentioned, there are some crossover between the senator's plan and the president's plan, and one of them is the pathway for legalization. But the Senate plan calls for the border to be secure before that process begins. What exactly does that mean, and how insecure is our border?
Well, we don't know exactly what that means, but I think the important thing about the Senate plan is that in the past, this idea that the border has to be secure before we can do anything else really did hold up everything else. What they're saying now is that they want to be certain that the border is secure and that enforcement is in place, but that while that process of determining border security is underway, simultaneously, they will allow for a registration and what they call a probationary legal status program to go into place for the unauthorized population.
They if then they pay say, these fines. If,
of course, pay fines, have a criminal right. background check and so on, which is absolutely part of anybody's plan. What they're saying is that they would hinge the ability of those people who get a probationary legal status, their ability to get a green card in the future would hinge on a determination of adequate border security.
But that
is
a
significant shift.
Of course,
it could be a moving target. But this is a very important shift from where people in the Republican Party and people that have been against immigration reform have been in the past. So you do have a parallel set of circumstances underway. The issue of border security, of course, not only is it a moving target, nobody has determined how you would determine whether border security is adequate. But it's a different discussion to be discussing how you measure that and how you determine that than what we've been hearing over the past 5, 7, 8 years, which is border control, border security, the borders are out of control.
Electrified fences.
Exactly.
Right.
This has shifted the ground. And so what you can envision, if they are able to go forward and enact legislation patterned on this formula that they're putting down, is a legal status program beginning to be implemented at the same time as the border security discussion continues.
Let me ask you a little bit about the term amnesty. Because of this plan in the Gang of Eight's proposal to allow a pathway to citizenship, some conservatives are calling that amnesty. And that wasn't what I thought the term amnesty meant. So could you kind of explain what amnesty is and whether or not that applies to either of these proposals, the president's or the senator's?
Well, so much of this is terminology and what words mean to you. When politicians talk about amnesty and no amnesty, what they're saying, I believe, is that the connotation of amnesty is no responsibility. You're simply forgiven and life goes on. What people who are talking about legalization, and particularly earned legalization, which is the important term that is being used in the bipartisan framework as well as by the president, is that, okay, you recognize that, yes, these people have violated the law. Yes, there is responsibility that must be taken by the individuals, but also by the society overall, which has allowed this to come to this point. And therefore, people should have the opportunity, because they have been contributing, to earn their way toward a legal status over time, beginning with in the case of the bipartisan framework, a probationary legal status. In the president's plan, he calls it a provisional legal status. There isn't too much difference between those terms. But that would involve registering with the government, having a background check to be certain that you're not a criminal or have any other criminal issues, and then paying a fine, which you could think of as something like a plea bargain or a agreement to having violated the law, and then that there be a demonstration over time that you're working and contributing and paying your taxes and paying back taxes. So that earning your way toward legal status that then would allow you to be eligible for a green card, that then would allow you to be eligible to apply for citizenship, that is not amnesty. In other words, the amnesty is simply you're forgiven, life goes on. And that is not what's being talked about here, and that's what people are using to argue against this simplistic notion, no amnesty.
So you have been working in this field, which I can only imagine has been very frustrating for a very long time. Dare I say, Doris Meissner, that at this point you're hopeful we'll get real immigration reform?
You can say that I am hopeful or cautiously optimistic. I do not think that this will be easy. The devil is always in the details. Agreements can break down. But the stars are aligned right now in a way that hasn't been the case for at least 6 years and possibly as much as a decade or more. So there is a possibility, and these are the beginnings of the kinds of discussions and compromises that could lead us out of this woods that we're in.
Well, if Doris Meissner is cautiously optimistic, I guess I can be too. A former official with the INS, a senior fellow and director of U.S. immigration policy at the Migration Policy Institute. She joined us here in our Washington, D.C. studios. Doris Meissner, thank you so much.
Thank you.
This is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Celeste Headlee. Michelle Martin is away. Coming up, we'll talk about how to protect kids' privacy when it comes to social media and how some of the old rules aren't keeping up with new tech. That's in just a few minutes. But first, we'll talk about a group of immigrants that for some reason are rarely discussed on Capitol Hill. According to the Migration Policy Institute, in 2011, African immigrants made up nearly 3% of the foreign-born population in this country. But some feel their experience is absent from the national conversation on immigration. And as a result, many African-born immigrants find themselves identifying as Black Americans. Wayetu Moore recently wrote about this in a piece for The Atlantic called How the Africans Became Black, and she sat down recently with Michelle Martin to talk about it.
Welcome to the program. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Now, you made an interesting argument here. Your argument is that kind of Africans are becoming subsumed under the broader banner of African Americans or Black people. And you draw an interesting parallel between the history of Irish immigrants in this country and African immigrants. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yes. I read Noel Ignatieff's How the Irish Became White a while ago, and he made a really great point about how the nation's white solidarity can be traced back to the arrival of Irish settlers and how Irish immigrants, for the most part, were seen as the Blacks of Europe. But when they came over, they began to be just as prejudiced or racist against Blacks to separate themselves from the stigma of being second-class citizens. So with African immigrants, I don't believe that it's something that's consciously done. I think that, and then also it's regionally based because, of course, when you think of Africans in New York or D.C., it's much different from what people consider Africans in Texas or Arizona, because in those places, what's considered Black is more homogenous.
So you were laying out this kind of interesting dynamic where you're saying that kind of Africans become a first-generation African diasporans, let's put it that way, sort of get subsumed under the umbrella of Black folks, right? Just Black folks in general. So is that a bad thing? Is it a good thing? Is it just a thing?
I don't consider it a good nor bad thing. It just is what it is. I think it's a result of our maybe homogenous view of what being American is. And growing up in Texas, it was Black, white, and Hispanic. And as far as we were concerned, a lot of the Hispanics, or all of the Hispanics, I should say, were Mexican or Mexican-American. So when I moved to New York for the first time, I remember at NYU I had a Puerto Rican friend, and I was like, oh, you know, you're Mexican. And she was, no, I'm Puerto Rican. But that was my consciousness at the time. That was my only awareness being in Texas. And I think the larger picture within America, it is, you know, Black, white, Hispanic. And unfortunately, when you think of Hispanic or when you think of that other, that is the group that gets labeled with immigrant.
Let me ask you why you started thinking about this to begin with. Your family is originally from Liberia.
Yes.
Right? Is that why you started thinking about this?
It wasn't until I moved to the Northeast, because in Texas I would always say, oh, you know, I'm black. And I moved to the North, and I remember I went to like a Black Student Association meeting in college, and you know, I referred to myself, you know, as African American, and someone looked at me like, you are not African American, you are African, you are Liberian. And I remember feeling so rejected and sort of offended, and I had one of those moments like, oh, like maybe am I that different, or am I different? And similarly, the same thing would happen once in a while when I went to African Association meetings, like, oh, well, how long have you been here? And I was like, since I was 5. And then of course that discourse changes as well to, oh, well, you're American now.
If you're just joining us, we are talking about the experience of African immigrants. Our guest is Wayetu Moore. She wrote a piece for The Atlantic called How the Africans Became Black. One of the reasons that you said that the Irish were viewed as the blacks of Europe, but came to this country and kind of took on prejudice, even though there were important voices urging them not to do this, for
right.
example, urging them to identify with the abolitionist struggle, but kind of as a, I don't know whether it was a conscious or unconsciously, sort of identified as white and in part as a way to kind of separate themselves from blacks and thereby kind of advantage themselves that way. You say that black immigrants are benefiting from a black racial umbrella. How so?
Absolutely. I mean, when our college counselors or high school counselors come to us with college scholarships, they were presenting African-American scholarships. They were presenting scholarships that would previously only be for, you know, native blacks or blacks whose ancestors may have been slaves or went through the civil rights movement. So black immigrants, a lot of time when they do get lumped in by people who are not black and cannot identify that they are different or of different heritage, they do get lumped into this black caveat, and the result is that we do end up benefiting in a number of ways. And, you know, the college scholarships, of course, that's just one example.
Well, but I would argue, on the other hand, I think a lot of people might argue that one of the strengths of America is at some point everybody's encouraged to think of themselves as American first.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the strengths of it, so that everybody is called upon at some point to subsume a part of their identity. And that's one reason why the country works. You know, what would you say to that?
I don't believe that in recognizing our maybe individual cultural identities takes away at all from what it means to be American. I think it strengthens it, because America is about inclusion of different cultures, inclusion of different histories. And so I actually agree with you.
You know, it's curious that our first African-American president actually has a journey by way of the African diaspora. You know, he does not have a typical African-American story.
Yes.
I mean, not just by being biracial, but because his family did not come through the segregated South, did not come mm-hmm. through the Jim Crow experience, did not come through the experience of slavery in the United States. I mean, his wife's family did, but he didn't. So in a way, it's kind of curious in a way, isn't mm-hmm. it, that your thesis that kind of Africans in general become subsumed under the banner of black, that perhaps that maybe that isn't actually true, that maybe the immigrant aspect of it does kind of persist.
I think it depends on the audience. There are people, including myself, who do consider Barack Obama an African American, and I consider myself an African American just by, I guess, cultural exposure. If Barack Obama were to say, hi, I'm just black, like, say, for instance, a Tiger Woods, don't call me African American is what he says all the time, then the dialogue would be different. But he associates himself with that culture. And so it depends on the audience. I feel like many people, as many people that oppose him, just as many accept him for that.
And finally, before we let you go, you wrote this piece in the context of the broader debate that the country's having over immigration and the way forward on immigration. What do you think the value would be if, I'm not quite sure, in a way, who you're talking to here? Are you saying that other African immigrants or first-generation immigrants from Africa should be more forthright about their African identity? What would be better? What would be different if they were?
I don't think that there should be any rejection of any culture. You know, I don't think that, you know, that a person has to reject African-American culture in order to be more in touch with, you know, their Liberianness. Because, I mean, as I mentioned in the article, I mean, my ancestors were slaves also. Where attention needs to be paid is the reform issue. Like, what can we do as Black immigrants, as a Black immigrant community, to raise awareness to the larger immigration debate and the larger immigration struggles of our fellow Americans? And those are the Browns, those are the Yellows, those are the many others, what's considered other in this culture that makes up the larger American blanket.
Wei Etu Moore is a freelance writer. Her article, How the Africans Became Black, is available online at theatlantic.com. She's also the owner of a publishing company, One More, that's with two O's, book. And she was kind enough to join us from our bureau in New York. Wei Etu Moore, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
We return now to Tell Me More's Social Me series, looking at how young people are interacting online. Earlier this week, we heard about how kids could benefit from developing their online identities and how educators can use data about social media to help shape better lessons. But today we're going to explore a potential downside of social media for children and ask whether digital privacy protection is keeping up with the growth of technology. Ray Hunko is a faculty associate at Harvard's Berkman Center for Internet and Society. Earlier, he joined Michelle Martin to discuss the issue.
Ray, welcome back. Thanks for joining us once again.
Hi, Michelle. Awesome to be here.
Ray, you know, often if you ever log on to a site that's meant for kids, or if you log on to a game or you try to download a game or something that's meant for kids, you'll see that it'll say, well, are you 13-year-old or do you have your parents' permission? Is that all because of the Children's Online Protection Privacy Act, or COPPA? Is that what that's all about?
Yes, that's correct. That's from COPPA.
Could you just briefly give us an idea of what kinds of protections children are supposed to have online now? And I understand that they recently changed, but just tell us what kinds of protections, sort of in general terms, kids are supposed to have when they go online.
In general, the idea behind COPPA was to protect children online and to keep their information private, to keep bad actors from getting their information, and to keep them from being marketed to in ways that are hypercharged, basically, by technology.
You know, one of the things that I think a lot of privacy advocates have talked about is that, you know, Americans are kind of funny when it comes to privacy. On the one hand, Americans are very adamant about their right to privacy. On the other hand, people routinely give away all kinds of information, mm-hmm. like mm-hmm. about how much money they make, about mm-hmm. their race, what they're going to buy, their sort of shopping habits. Do you find that people are more vigilant when it comes to their kids, or are they still kind of lax in actually giving away information, even if they don't necessarily want people to have it?
You know, I think there's an interesting catch-22 here, just like you've identified, that there's research. For instance, there was a recent Pew Internet and American Life Project Berkman Center survey of parents who have teenagers, and 81% of the parents of teens who go online say they are concerned about how much information advertisers can learn about their child's online behavior. 69% of parents of online teens are concerned about how their child's online activity might affect their future academic or employment opportunities. Yet, one of the reasons why the changes occurred in COPPA was because there was all of this other data collection that was happening that most people weren't really attuned to. And I think that was one of the big stories when we talked about this that last time, was that people didn't really get that these apps were tracking kids in these ways.
I thought you had some research on this point about how kids themselves view online privacy.
Well, youth are much savvier about their online privacy than most adults give them credit for. So research on their online behavior shows that they adjust privacy settings and behave in ways that show that they're very aware of privacy issues. But the research is mostly conducted on teenagers and not on younger children, and it's mostly conducted on teenagers using specific sites like Facebook and MySpace. And some of the things that happen with other kinds of tracking are well beyond typical privacy concerns of parents, but also of youth.
What advice do you have for parents and caregivers going forward, and teens themselves, for that matter, who are listening to this conversation? And, you know, you want to go online, you want to experience what's out there, but you don't necessarily want your personal information being sort of tracked forever. Is there anything you should be particularly aware of? Is there really anything you can do?
One of my favorite plugins for my browser is Do Not Track Plus, which sits in your browser and doesn't allow you to be tracked across websites and blocks these queries about your personal information and about what sites you're visiting and about your behavior in order to serve up different kinds of advertisement to you.
So looking ahead, are there other policy changes that you would like to see made to address this?
Well, the problem with the current rules is that they can't foresee all of the applications right now. Plus, they can't foresee all of the applications in the future. So for me, it's more of a process issue because before the rules were updated, we saw that developers for apps for kids were collecting information without providing notice. They used a, you know, basically a loophole in COPPA that didn't cover a new technology such as mobile devices. And I use new in air quotes because, I mean, mobile technologies obviously aren't new to us, but they're new to COPPA because COPPA's been around for so long. So part of the problem is that the current models of making money online involves a system by which a website is touted as free, but then data is harvested and used for advertising in ways that we would consider an unacceptable privacy breach for our children. I would consider them an unacceptable privacy breach for all of us. But such a popular business model doesn't really mesh well with protecting privacy. So I don't think that there are going to be static rules that are going to hold for very long periods of time, given the rapid advances in technology that we see. But I think it's important to have a process by which the FTC can continually make and enforce updates.
Before we let you go, Ray, over the course of the last 3 days, as we've said, we've talked about a couple things. We've talked about the online identities question. I mean, the idea of anonymity online has gotten a really bad rap, particularly when it comes to kids. And you've pointed out how Sure. that can actually be a positive thing in some ways. You've talked about the fact that, you know, online use can be constructive. It can help people figure out how kids can learn better if they use that information, you know, properly. And today, of course, we talked about, you know, the privacy question. When you think sort of overall about the way our young people are interacting with technology, with the internet, are you mostly excited and are you fearful in some ways?
Well, I'm actually optimistic about it. I'm often told that I'm too optimistic, which is kind of funny because I don't really consider myself an optimist. I consider myself a realist, and sometimes, at least to me, that comes off as being pretty negative about the future. But I think that these technologies really hold such promise for education, for interpersonal interactions, for exploring things about ourselves, our identities, our psychological makeup that we've never been able to do before with other kinds of tools. And I think it allows us for some really neat and expansive ways to grow and develop. And so I'm talking about youth here, but I'm also talking about adults as well. And I think I'm really optimistic about it.
Ray Junco is a faculty associate at the Harvard Berkman Center for Internet and Society. He joined us from WPSU at Penn State University. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks a lot, Michelle.
If you missed any of our previous conversations in our Social Me series, please go to our website and check it out. Go to npr.org, click on the Programs tab, and then on Tell Me More.
I'm Celeste Headlee, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Michelle Martin is away. Now we want to tell you about a performer who may have been a big part of your life when you were still in short pants, if I can use that expression. Before there were Ozo Kids and Raffi filling packed houses, there was Ella Jenkins. For more than 50 years, she's been using the power of song to educate children and teach them lessons about life and the importance of staying active.
Oh, well, you walk and you walk and you walk and you stop. And you walk, and you walk, and you walk, and you stop. And you walk, and you walk, and you walk, and you stop. And you walk, and you walk, and you walk, and you stop. Oh, well, you skate, and you skate, and you skate, and you stop. And you skate, and you skate, and you skate, and you stop. And you skate, and you skate, and you skate, and you stop. And you skate, and you skate, and you skate, and you stop. Well, you tap your knees, tap your knees, tap your knees.
That was Ella Jenkins performing Stop and Go. She's won numerous honors, including a Grammy Lifetime Achievement Award, and she's even had her recordings immortalized at the Library of Congress. Now Ella Jenkins has a new album out called Get Moving with Ella Jenkins, and she joined Michelle Martin to talk about that album and her career.
Welcome, my diva. Thank you for joining us.
Oh, how generous you are, diva. I shall remember that word.
Well, how are you doing?
A couple of responsibilities.
Yes, it does. Including, you know, the other title that you are known by. You've been dubbed the First Lady of Children's Music. And as you know, being the First Lady carries some weight with that title.
Right.
What does it feel like to have that title?
It feels as if, although I was never married and had children, but I feel like I have a host of children around the world.
How did you get started doing, I don't know how you feel about the phrase children's entertainment, but if that's okay with you, but how did you get started in this particular kind of work?
Well, you know, actually I used to work as a volunteer and then sometimes as a camp counselor. And I went to children's camps as a leader and how much fun the children used to have at camp. And so one of the things they didn't do too much of, and it was singing. So I used to do a lot of singing when I was a child. And then I started writing songs myself. And I remember when I was growing up, children, and especially little children, were supposed to be just seen and not heard. And most children didn't enter school until kindergarten. They didn't have what you call preschool. So right away, I was able to get my hands on them.
Oh, you had because the kids had more time.
Or their voices.
Right.
But I never expected to grow up and have this as a great part of my life. But I'm so glad because over the years, I've met some nice parents and grandparents and many other kind of relatives who children are related to. And it's really nice that I've been able to teach a lot of their children many songs and rhythms and rhymes.
Let's play one of them from the new album, which is a compilation of, you know, songs that you've recorded over the years. Over the years. Let's play Hop, Skip, and Jump to My Lou. Let's hear a little bit of that.
Skip, skip, skip to my Lou. Everybody, skip, 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 skip to my Lou. Skip, skip, skip to my Lou. Skip to my Lou.
All right, if you want to clap it out, all right.
Skip, skip, skip to my loo. Skip, skip, skip to my loo. Skip, skip, skip to my loo.
One little child going on her own.
On her own, that's right. You still get a kick out of hearing this. It's so funny. You've been chuckling the whole time. You still get a kick out of it.
They give me a pleasure, and you know, we always send we adults, we're going to teach the children, but I learn a great deal from the children, just from their songs and rhythms and rhymes and games and some of the games that they play. There's a play lot right across the street from where I live, and it's wonderful to hear these little voices. I begin to wonder, what are children all about? What are they talking about so early? But they're over there playing and singing and dancing. It's wonderful. So they teach me a great deal too.
Well, you know, that's funny because it's funny that you say it that way because one of the things I noticed in listening to the album is that you're constantly suggesting that actually the kids are leading the song, the singing. You're actually suggesting that you're doing what they want. You say, oh, do you want to do X, Y, and Z? And
Well, that's the kind of communication that I try to have with the children, you know. We sometimes, as adults, we'll say we do it this way, like even giving a concert on stage. My concerts are never just standing up singing for an hour or 45 minutes, but the children are a great interactor. So I toss it out to them, and they toss it back to me. So it's very, very, very important that they're an instrumental part of what I do.
I would like to, though, ask where you got that idea from, because, as I said, your ideas now are very much accepted, but I think it's fair to say that when a lot of us were growing up, it wasn't that way. It was parent says, you do this, and child was expected to follow. And the idea that a child might have some say in what he or she was doing was really not you know, universal idea when you started singing. I'm just wondering, do you even remember how you got the idea that
well,
kids should have some say?
I was born in St. Louis, Missouri, but I grew up in Chicago, Illinois. And we had a wonderful theater called the Regal Theater. And I used to go there because that was where you had live entertainment. And one of the people that intrigued me a great deal, and then that's where I got some of these ideas, it was a man called Cab Calloway. Have you heard of him?
I think I have.
He was in that movie called The Blues Brothers. And so some of what he did was a call and response. He'd say, hi-dee, 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 hi. And then you'd say it back, hi-dee, ho-dee, ho-dee, ho-dee. And so I started doing this not only with his songs. I thought I would make up a few songs myself. And the children can learn very easily by imitating, following the leader, and then pretty soon be able to teach it themselves.
If you're just joining us, our guest is Ella Jenkins. She is known as the First Lady of Children's Music. She's been performing, traveling, and working with kids for, I don't know, how long should we say?
It's
a long time.
Many miles. Many miles and many years, yes.
She actually has a new album coming out. It's called Get Moving with Ella Jenkins.
And I say that it doesn't matter how many years, but it's what you do with those years in between, right?
That's right. Well, do you think kids have changed over the years?
I think they have because there's children nowadays are exposed to a lot more. First of all, there's a lot more offered in programs and schools and churches. And children today are quick learners because they've been stimulated to do so. Our schools have changed. And even our playtime has changed. And so even when the children are playing, sometimes they're incorporating some of the things they've learned in school or in church.
Is that a good thing or a bad thing from your perspective?
Oh, I think it's a good thing because they have an opportunity not only to do it, but they can also make up their own and they can, you know, change things around a little bit. And so we, as adults, find ourselves observing them and learning also.
I'm gonna play another song from the album. It's Who Fed the Chickens? Let's hear that. And you can tell us more about
it. Okay, all right.
These are called pronouns. You'll know about those sometime.
Who fed the chickens?
I did.
Who stacked the hay?
I did.
Who milked the cow?
I did.
On this fine day, once again now, who fed the chickens? Who stacked the hay?
I did.
Who milked the cows?
I did.
On this fine day.
Now I want you to point to a girl or to a woman, but don't touch anyone, and say, she did. Who fed the chicken?
She did.
Who stacked the hay?
She did.
Who milked the cows?
She did.
On this
fine day. Point to another girl or woman.
I love that. These are pronouns. You'll learn about that one day, but you're already learning about that. That's so funny.
And they listen very carefully because each child wants to be successful. And so it's not really a challenge, but they want to make sure that they can do it correctly. And then when they're at play around their own home, around their own church, they might share it with some other children.
As I mentioned, you've won many honors over the course of your career, and some of the things I didn't mention, you were the first female and first children's musician to receive the ASCAP Foundation's Lifetime Achievement Award that came in 1999, and you are believed to have been one of the first African-American women to have a regular television program. In the 50s, you hosted the Totem Club, that was a weekly children's program broadcast in Chicago.
I'm glad you said Totem Club, because people used to watch that show. And they said, oh, Ella, I saw you on the totem pole. I said, I was not totem pole. Totem club.
Did you see yourself as a pioneer?
You know, I was so busy just, you know, copying and trying to learn and then even listening to recordings. I never thought all of a sudden people would start following me. No, I never. But anyway, when they said that I am, I feel really honored, and I want to do more things and share more with the children as well as adults.
Do you think you have some wisdom that you'd like to pass on to us after all these years of performing and working with kids? And
I think most people like music, and most children like music, and there's a variety of music. But whatever you happen upon, what something that you feel that you really like, I'd say listen to it, and listen to it often. And if you want to kind of emulate it, if you want to try to repeat or imitate, do it in a way that when you're sharing it, someone else is going to think it's beautiful too. So there are a lot of wonderful composers around the world, and sometimes we get a lot of them right here in Chicago. But anyway, when you get these and you start to sing, or you can dance like the people that you have heard or watched, then put your best performance forward, and I think the children will do the same.
Many people who've seen you recently have remarked on just how, and people can hear it in your voice, just how happy you sound. are you always so happy?
Well, you know, I feel, as I say, when I awaken in the morning, I just say, good morning, world. You know, it's really nice because I'm just glad to, there's another day. And I don't think I could ever meet anyone that I don't receive something. Every child, every adult is different. And I always feel that I'm growing every time I meet somebody new.
Ella Jenkins is the First Lady of Children's Music. She has a new album out. It's available now. It's called Get Moving with Ella Jenkins. And she was kind enough to join us from member station WBEZ in Chicago. Ella Jenkins, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me.
Finally, you know those movies you pull out time and time again when you have nothing else to watch? Our colleagues at Weekends on All Things Considered regularly ask filmmakers and actors about the movies they never get tired of watching. Today, one of the founding members of the rap group, the Wu-Tang Clan, shares one of his favorites.
What's up? How y'all doing out there? My name is DaRizza. I'm a film director. And one of the films that I've seen a million times is The Good, The Bad, and The Ugly, starring Clint Eastwood, Lee Van Cleef, Eli Wallach, directed by Sergio Leone, and music by the great, great Morricone. The first time I saw The Good, The Bad, The Ugly had to be with my grandfather, actually, who was a big Western fan. And well, the first time I saw it, it was just the coolness of the gun shooting and everything like that. But as I watched it again, you know, in my teenage years, I was just blown away by the way the scenes were set up, the way the characters were all just uniquely separate, but yet had to come together, you know what I mean?
There are two kinds of people in the world, my friend. Those with a rope around their neck and the people who have the job of doing the cutting. Listen, the neck at the end of the rope is mine. I run the risks.
You may run the risks, my friend, but I do the cutting.
But someone who's never seen this film, this is a film by three different individuals, all out for the same thing, which is money.
Hey, amigo, you know you've got a face beautiful enough to be worth $2,000?
Yeah. But you don't look like the one who'll collect it.
If I had to pick one scene, which is hard, this is a hard one to pick one scene, but let's just say one of my coolest scenes is Eli Wallach when he's in the tub and a guy comes in, boom.
I've been looking for you for 8 months.
He had shot the guy and the guy couldn't shoot with his right hand no more.
Whenever I should have had a gun in my right hand, I thought of you.
But now I know how to shoot with my left.
Now I find you in exactly the position that suits me.
But why, by the time he finishes saying what he's going to say, Eli Wallach says, shoot something.
When you have to shoot, shoot, don't talk.
Then there's a music sting. Then Clint Eastwood comes to the great line.
Every gun makes
every
its
gun
own
has
tune.
Its own tune. When I watched it on DVD, this is when I really learned to appreciate the film. Because by now, TV screens got bigger. And you can see the scope of the cinematography and of the wide shots. And I was able to catch the barrenness of these cities or these villages. it's funny. This movie is, to me, an American classic, even though it's an Italian film.
That's the RZA talking about the movie that he could watch a million times, Sergio Leone's The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. The RZA spoke with our colleagues at Weekends on All Things Considered. And that's our program for today. I'm Celeste Headlee, and you've been listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. Tune in for more talk tomorrow.